Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Ian. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Colombia. Just this past weekend, the president, Álvaro Uribe, was elected to a second term as president of Colombia. He is someone who is known to be a friend of the United States in a region where both the Bush administration doesn't have a lot of friends. He has taken a tough stand against both leftist guerrillas and right-wing paramilitaries, and that has earned him the support of many, many Colombians. At the same time, political violence and crime related to drugs continue to make Colombia one of the world's most dangerous places. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll talk about Colombia and about relations between Colombia and the United States with Adam Isaacson from the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He's worked on Latin American security issues, particularly American policy toward Central America and Colombia since 1995. He's been to Colombia many times, has a master's degree in international relations from Yale, and worked previously for the Arias Foundation for Peace and Human Progress in San Jose, Costa Rica. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, as always, questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, people with questions are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good no matter where you're listening. If it would be a long-distance call, you can use that around Illinois, Indiana. People who are listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Isaacson, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate
pleasure.
It. Well, perhaps we just can start with what has happened here just most recently with the re-election of Mr. Uribe. He now is going to have a second term, and I know that that's something that maybe at one point in Colombia would have been a bit controversial because it required a change in the constitution. His re-election, in the stories that I've read about it, the reporters used the word landslide, so he certainly got the support of a lot of Colombians. How significant was his election to a second term?
It was enormously significant. Yes, Colombia traditionally has been rather cautious and sensitive about electing their leaders to second or third terms, having them repeat, because of the danger of movement toward dictatorship or too strong executive power. And this was a landslide. Uribe was popular throughout his term, mainly because of his security policies, and he ended up taking 62% of the vote, 40 points ahead of the number two vote-getter.
Perhaps we can talk just a little bit more about him, about Mr. Uribe.
Sure. He is from a wealthy background, sort of from the horse country outside of Medellin, an area that is traditionally very, very conservative, very pro-business, and also has a bit of a problem with, I mean, it's also been a heartland for Colombia's drug trade, and also its problem with right-wing paramilitarism, the formation of militias to fight off guerrillas, which these militias also became sort of almost death squads, the main committers of human rights abuses throughout much of the last 20 years. Uribe comes from that sort of very conservative stock. He became mayor of Medellin in the mid-80s, actually at the time when Pablo Escobar really ran Medellin, went on to become a senator and then governor of the surrounding state or department around Medellin, which is called Antioquia, back in the mid-90s, at a time when he oversaw the formation of sort of private security collectives under the government's auspices. So security and fighting the guerrillas and sort of ignoring right-wing violence has been sort of a consistent problem or a consistent pattern in Uribe's background. Now, Colombia went through a period of some really failed presidencies. From 94 to 98, President Ernesto Samper had his U.S. visa revoked because of a scandal that just damaged his presidency fatally, a scandal involving him taking money from the Cali cartel for his campaign. So the country limped along. And then his successor, Andres Pastrana, who is now Colombia's ambassador to the U.S., Pastrana spent most of his 4 years trying to negotiate peace with the guerrillas. That process fell apart near the end of his term, and the violence got worse and worse throughout his 4 years. And in the background, starting out sort of as a right-wing fringe character, this Álvaro Uribe would give interviews in the media and give fiery speeches around the country condemning this peace process, saying, why are you negotiating with these leftist terrorists? And, you know, by 2002, in the wake of the whole, you know, post-9/11 anti-terrorist mood everywhere, and in the wake of Colombians' frustration with the guerrillas, with the peace attempt, with there was a real war fever in Colombia that just carried Uribe, who, as a third-party candidate, was polling less than 10% in 2001, but it really carried him into a first-round victory in May of 2002. And Uribe implemented hardline security policies, increasing the size of the military by 25%, sending up networks of hundreds of thousands of informants among the citizenry, installing security force presence just about everywhere in the country where it had been lacking, although not really installing much other government presence, increasing the fumigation with herbicides from aircraft of coca crops throughout the country. And in general, obviously, not being very aggressive in pursuing human rights complaints against the armed forces, and then, of course, negotiating a demilitarization or demobilization pact with the right-wing paramilitary groups. Now, the security policies, one thing he did do that was very smart was deploying the military, getting them off their bases, and getting the military and police into areas where people live, the main towns and along the main roads. And that pushed the guerrillas largely out into more remote areas, where the guerrillas have almost the same membership, the same income stream, the same sort of leadership, but they have not been able to kidnap people as much or launch attacks on populations as much. And for that, the Colombian people are quite grateful. They can now drive their car to the beach, or the trucks carrying cargo can go from one big city to another without worry about hitting a guerrilla roadblock. And the security alone is really the thing that carried Uribe into this overwhelming second term victory.
Mm-hmm. How was how controversial was this question of change the constitution so that he could have the second term?
It was pretty controversial because Uribe, of course, does face opposition from the traditional liberal party and from Colombia's left. There was even among his supporters, some were nervous about writing a blank check to a president. I mean, Colombia had put no re-election in its constitution for a reason. There was a suspicion of consistently growing executive power. So even though the president was always polling above 60 and sometimes above 70% in his approval ratings, it barely squeaked through at first in Colombia's Congress. The vote in the committee in Congress at the end of 2004 was only 18-16, and they had to do a little arm twisting and a little, you could almost call it, buying of votes in order to get undecided members to vote in favor of this, promising the construction of projects in their districts and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that that Colombia and the government has a positive relationship with the United States. At least it is not so combative as the relationship between some of its neighbors. For example, Venezuela, which is right next door, has had with the United States. As far as most Colombians are concerned, does the relationship with the United States matter, particularly as they think about their government? And for example, as people were going to the polls and thinking, were they going to vote to reelect the standing president, does the relationship between Colombia and the United States influence the way that they see their own leadership?
Yes and no. I mean, Colombians do not want to pick a fight with the United States. They already lived through that during the years that Ernesto Samper was president, the president who lost his U.S. visa. And they probably don't want to go back to having the U.S. being antagonistic. When you ask them about U.S. drug policy, however, most Colombians tend to be quite critical of the U.S. emphasis on fumigating areas where peasants grow small plots of coca. They don't like, in general, there's very mixed opinions about the policy of extraditing Colombians to the United States. to stand trial for sending drugs, even though they've never set foot on U.S. soil. So when you ask about drug policy, there's a lower opinion, because our drug policy has been quite punitive. There's a much lower opinion in Colombia about a free trade agreement with the United States. There's nervousness that, you know, they'll be flooded with subsidized, you know, cheaper U.S. agricultural goods that'll wipe out farmers there and maybe push them into the coca trade also. So it depends on what you ask about. Although most Colombians do claim to have a higher opinion of the United States than they do in say, Venezuela or Bolivia, it still depends issue by issue. However, and certainly the Iraq War was not popular among most Colombians either. However, on all of these issues, Uribe is a strong proponent of the current U.S. drug policy and even wants to go more punitive than the United States has even been doing. He did sign a free trade agreement with the United States at the end of February, and he's actually one of the only Latin American leaders that supported the Iraq War, although he did not send troops. So he is one of the few really unquestioning backers of the Bush administration's policies in Latin America, even more to more of an extent than even than Vicente Fox in Mexico or certainly Lula in Brazil, much less the more radical leaders like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela or Evo Morales in Bolivia. So the United States does sort of, he is being viewed more and more as a bulwark or a counterweight to his neighbors in the region, and certainly people in the Bush administration hope that Uribe's model of, you know, unfettered free market and a real military vision of security, they hope, and small government, they hope that that model succeeds so that they can show that it works better than what Hugo Chavez and others are proposing.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Adam Isaacson. He's senior associate at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Colombia, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're just talking a little bit about Colombia, the United States, and one of the things in a number of the articles that I've read suggests that one of the challenges that Mr. Uribe will face has to do with how it is he manages his relationship with Hugo Chavez, who's the leader of Venezuela and who has been very outspoken in his criticism of the United States, has this very combative relationship with the United States. Is that particularly problematic, that is, the relationship between the governments of Colombia and Venezuela?
The relationship between Colombia and Venezuela is, it's historically, it's never been great. There's always been a bit of a rivalry, even before Chavez. Now, Chavez and Uribe are ideological opposites, but they are also quite similar in that they're both rather strongman leaders that like to centralize everything in the office of the president, and they're both quite popular at home. So far, relations have not been that bad. Sometimes between the two governments, crises will erupt. For instance, when Colombian forces about a year and a half ago paid to have a guerrilla leader abducted from Caracas and kidnapped to Colombian soil. That didn't go over well in Venezuela. More recently, Venezuela pulled out of the Andean region's sort of weak version of a trade regime because in protest of Colombia's signature of a free trade pact with the United States. So there are problems like that. In general, though, the two leaders tend to like each other. When they meet together, tensions seem to disappear for a long time. When they have summits, they hug and chat, and they do seem to have a genuine affinity. And Chavez has already said in public he's glad that Uribe won, which is interesting. Now, both countries are each other's second-largest trading partner also, and if they were ever to close that border or cease trade relations, both of them would see a deep recession or depression in their border zones, which neither of them want. Also, Venezuela really wants to sell oil and natural gas to China without having to, you know, send tankers through the Panama Canal. Their best way of doing that would be to build a pipeline through Colombia, which Uribe has been interested in helping them with. And, you know, plans are still on the drawing board, but it is something they talk about often, and it's another reason why they would keep having good relations.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that in Champaign County, here where we are, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hi. The pipeline was one of the things on my list of things that I was going to try and interact on. I'll start with that and then see how much time there is, if there's anybody waiting. But I gather the U.S. is steadfastly against that. And since the U.S. gives, I don't know what the latest per year billion dollars is for Colombia, they have a lot of leverage, and I assume that they'll probably would be enhancing things to slow that down. I thought that was a signed deal. I didn't know that it was announced just after Uribe was in Washington, so I thought they had clearance on it in some way. But it's probably a bargaining chip, I guess. There's some more on that, and there's a widespread perception here, I guess, in the U.S. that Uribe is cracking down on the paras, and it seems to me the paras have been on the terrorist list before 9/11 a long time, and it was announced by Powell. You probably can do the timeline better than I.
Right.
But what I hear from Colombians and what I hear from analysis is that they're getting like scholarships basically and work grants and all sorts of things. Now more paras have been killed by internecine battling over the cocaine trade. I understand that's apparently how the famous guy whose name I can't remember, Carlos
Castaño,
got offed, I guess. So it just seems to me that we have this sort of myth of even-handedness, and I don't know where you come down on that. I'd like for you to talk about that a bit, too.
Sure. Well, first, on the pipeline, I think that the United States probably won't be too happy about Venezuela being able to get its oil to China more easily. If that were to happen, obviously, the chance of Venezuela cutting off its sales of oil to the United States would be increased. However, I mean, Colombia stands to gain a lot of money from this deal. I mean, they would get a cut of anything that goes through their territory. So I think actually anything we could give Colombia would be outweighed by what they could gain from the money from that pipeline. So I think that the United States would actually lose that discussion. Now, the paramilitaries is a huge issue. You've got about 30,000, 31,000 of these right-wing, sort of it's a hybrid between death squad and army. About 31,000 of them turned in their weapons, or actually turned in about 16,000 weapons during the last couple of years as a result of a rebase talks with them. The paramilitaries were united under an umbrella organization called the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the AUC. And the AUC, on September 10th, 2001, was added to the State Department's list of foreign terrorist organizations. You're right, Colin Powell did that just before he was scheduled to visit Colombia on 9/11, which he never did. Now, the paramilitaries get the bulk of their money from the drug trade, and in order to grow, they tripled in size between the late 90s and the early 2000s. In order to grow, their marriage with the drug lords of the country was really consummated to the point where you couldn't tell where the cartels ended and the paramilitaries began. Now, the guerrillas also make money from the drug trade, but the paramilitaries are higher up in the chain. So you had these paramilitary leaders, many of them members of the drug trade, with enormous political power in areas they controlled, which they continue to have. Uribe, when he came into office, said, "I will negotiate peace with any armed group that first declares a unilateral ceasefire." The guerrillas, of course, said, "Forget it, we're not going to do that." But within a couple of months, the paramilitary said, "Okay, we'll declare a ceasefire. Let's talk about our demobilization." Of course, the ceasefire was not complete. The paramilitaries have killed about 4,000 civilians since December 2002 when they said they'd have a ceasefire, but never mind, the peace talks kept going. And actually, 4,000 was less than they were killing before. Now, you had a gradual process of all these guys demobilizing. The question is, have the paramilitary structures actually dismantled? In a lot of the areas where the paramilitaries are strong, you've got almost a right-wing independent republic going on where the paramilitary leaders are the true power. They sort of like mafia leaders almost. They've got many of their quote-unquote former members are hitmen on call who will still make it very, very hard for you if you want to be a union leader or a human rights activist or an opposition politician or an independent journalist. Your life is still endangered by these guys. They are most likely still sending drugs to U.S. shores as we speak, but they have negotiated something resembling an amnesty for themselves. These very powerful warlords now have avoided extradition to the United States and are looking forward to jail terms maximum 8 years, in special jails, of course, even though they may be the planners of innumerable massacres and the displacement of millions of people from their homes and the stealing of millions and millions of acres of land from the people they've kicked out of their homes. A lot of people in Colombia think that's unfair, obviously, but right now they don't have much recourse. Victims are hoping to get reparations, and there is a law requiring reparations, but determining what really belongs to whom is going to take a very, very long time. Meanwhile, there is an interest in helping, obviously, a lot of the rank-and-file paramilitaries. You've got a lot of these guys who are not the planners of massacres. They're just 18- or 19-year-old guys who don't really have a lot of skills other than using a weapon. And you do want to be able to reintegrate those guys into society somehow to, as you mentioned, give them scholarships or give them skills or something else so that they don't just go back into the criminal underworld. And right now there's concern that that process is really sort of thrown together haphazard and underfunded. The concern is that this paramilitary process that I've tried to describe here could blow up during Uribe's second term and could really end up being the Achilles heel of the second part of his presidency. Whether it's violence from unintegrated former paramilitaries, whether it's guerrillas moving back into some former paramilitary zones, whether it's these warlords really becoming a mafioso political power in much of Colombia, or whether it's evidence that these guys are sending drugs and the United States demanding their extradition and still not getting it, and therefore causing a crisis in U.S. relations, there's any number of ways that this could be a huge problem for Uribe in the second term.
One thing you said there at the very top was that when you started talking about the paras, is that, what did you say, 33,000 surrendered,
yeah,
half as many weapons?
That's right.
That sounds a little bogus to begin with. I doubt whether that means that all the weapons were surrendered. I don't know how many people know that the second largest place of military contractors, as they're, quote, mercenaries that the U.S. is using behind Iraq is, I believe, Colombia. I don't think there are so many in the New Orleans area anymore as there were when Blackwater was down there. But that's always been this dance between how many could be. There's also, I think, nearly 1,000 uniformed U.S. military, right? I forget it. They were dancing around what the limits would be and what the ratio of contractors to. This is a outrageous thing, it seems to me, just on the face of it, just putting aside all the rest of the arguments that we're developing this contractor system. I'll have to run, but Chicago is actually linked into some of the indigenous movements in a fairly interesting way. There's a website, just Chicagoans.net, that is basically dedicated to a group that works with Colombia, and they were witnessing a indigenous gathering that was just recently, just before the election, that was overrun by 800 riot troops, and that doesn't make much press up here. And locally on college campuses, there's a CU coalition against Coke contracts about the abuses of the franchisees of Coca-Cola down in Colombia. Anybody can just, and I appreciate Ambassador White's website too, actually. I think that's who you're affiliated with. I have to run. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions are certainly welcome. We'll continue to talk with our guest, Adam Isaacson. He's Director of Programs at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He's worked on Latin American security issues, particularly U.S. policy toward Central America and Colombia since 1995 there at the center. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We touched on the fact that here, this country, Colombia, has been struggling with decades of conflict involving, on the one hand, left-wing rebels that said that they were working in sympathy and support of the majority of Colombians, and they're the poor people, and the right paramilitaries who are, it is said, working to maintain the interests of the people on the top, the smaller number of people at the top who have all the good stuff. And at the same time, though, as often happens in conflicts like these, as they age, what happens is the political motivations begin to be lost. And some of these groups that began with one kind of political agenda seemingly become criminal gangs. And the politics just aren't that important anymore. Has that happened in Colombia? To what extent has that happened?
I think that has absolutely happened, sort of the dilution of the original political goals or the political reason why these groups exist has been seen in almost all cases. I would argue that the dilution is greater in the case of the paramilitaries and the guerrillas, although certainly, especially in the case of the FARC, you've seen so many attacks on the very populations that the FARC would claim to protect, indigenous groups, poor peasants. These are the guys who are very often the victim of attacks on populations, of even extortions and kidnappings, to the point where you wonder why they would be antagonizing their would-be base so much. I say that the FARC have not completely, they haven't completely gone off into being a bunch of bandits or a cartel. The main evidence of that is that we have not heard at all that the money that the FARC gains, be it from the drug trade, be it from kidnapping, we have not heard of that money being plowed into Swiss bank accounts and swimming pools and villas and nice, you know, luxuries. By all accounts, that money is going still into the FARC's war effort. It's going into guns, which means that it must be paying for something. They must be fighting for some reason other than just power for its own sake. And certainly they maintain a website and put out ideological statements all the time, which sort of a mixture of Marxism, 60s-era Marxism, combined with a real visceral hatred of the ruling class in Colombia. Now, the paramilitaries there is more evidence that money that paramilitary leaders gain from the drug trade and otherwise does get plowed into a more luxurious lifestyle. Paramilitary leaders tend to be quite wealthy and have vast land holdings and other properties. And there have been increasing examples cited by the Colombian authorities of paramilitaries and guerrillas doing drug business together. We'll give you precursor chemicals in exchange for some coca paste, or let's share this drug route, or let's do this shipment together, which indicates that the paramilitaries are increasingly viewing or the so-called ex-paramilitaries, I should say, are increasingly viewing the guerrillas less as sort of blood enemies and more like just a rival mafia in the drug trade. That, of course, dilutes the guerrillas' purpose as well, since these are the representatives of the right and the landowners in rural areas. You've got that dynamic definitely happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gets at what is, I'm sure, a fundamental problem and challenge for the government, and that is this dynamic that we see not only in Colombia, we see a lot of other places in the region, that is this very stratified society where you have those people who traditionally have had most of the wealth, the people who are at the top, the people who are of European descent, and everybody else that tends to be the indigenous people who have much less, and the tension that comes from that very fundamental inequality when it comes to the nation's resources and the nation's wealth. Is that something that the president is trying to address?
Well, yeah, it's hard to understand Colombia or any of Latin America unless you do think of class. This is by far the least equal region in the world, and Colombia is near the bottom of that. The UNDP's latest estimate is that the top 10% earns 42 times what the bottom 10% earns in a year, and that more than two-thirds of arable land is in the hands of less than 1% of the population. So you're right. That is a huge reason. It's a huge reason why Colombia has for so long been conflictive, and it's a reason why a small group of people has long been above the law and able to get benefit from impunity for some of the most outrageous behavior. Now, Uribe's response to redistribution of wealth or redistribution of resources is similar to what the Bush administration would propose, that he would not see a role for the Colombian government in doing that. He would oppose greater taxation on the wealthiest sliver of Colombians, although he has charged taxes to pay for greater military expenditure. And he would expect that the magic of the market would redistribute some of Colombia's wealth and property, and that the extending opportunity, eradicating obstacles to participation in the market economy would be the goal. And he would definitely buy into and actually has espoused the argument that the free trade agreement with the United States is one of the best ways of reducing poverty in Colombia, which is still exceeds 50%, could be as high as 60% of the population in poverty, which means earning $3 a day or less. And the hope is simply that the market would take care of this. Obviously, people in much of the rest of Latin America have not have been really discouraged by that sort of orthodoxy. This was a real majority view among leaders in Latin America until quite recently. Throughout the 2000s, particularly due to high commodity prices, Latin America's economy has been growing pretty rapidly. The whole region is averaging about 5% a year GDP growth, which is, you know, we haven't seen rates like that since the 70s. However, poverty hasn't budged. And while where people see, you know, the wealth being accumulated but not being distributed, they get angry. And that's why, probably the number one reason why leftist candidates are doing so well in so much of Latin America. Now, a general rule of thumb is that in parts of Latin America where these economic concerns are still eclipsed by security concerns, be it because of guerrillas or be it because of gang activity like you see in Central America or Mexico, when people feel insecure, they still tend to vote for the right-wing guy. They still tend to vote for the one who promises the iron fist approach, be it Uribe, be it Tony Saca in El Salvador, or even Felipe Calderon in Mexico. And they will still turn to that guy. But when security is less on people's minds, they start noticing that they are not seeing the wealth trickle down, and they do vote for the Hugo Chavez or the Lula or the Vasquez in Uruguay or Kirchner in Argentina because they've had it with the reigning economic orthodoxy.
Let's take another caller here. We have someone in Champaign to talk with next, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm really interested in seeing if you could help contextualize some of these issues you're talking about in terms of the role of Coca-Cola in Colombia. For instance, what are the union organizers really fighting for? Is it the paramilitary that are being used to intimidate and assassinate these union organizers? And then I'm also interested in knowing, is Coca-Cola one of the few companies that is able to buy the coca leaf and export it in their drink?
Okay, that's two questions. First, Coca-Cola has come under heavy fire because mainly around 2000, 2001, I don't know the exact dates, some people in northern Colombia who had tried, some of the workers at Coca-Cola bottling plants, who tried to organize a union, or whose union was getting more active and aggressive in negotiations, had some of its members killed. Killed probably by paramilitary groups. The allegation is that the people who ran these bottling plants asked the paramilitaries to take care of the union problem for them, and they did. As a result, you've seen a lot of universities in the United States and Europe boycotting Coca-Cola, a lot of activism around this issue. Now, Coca-Cola, their defense has been, well, we don't think this really happened, but either way, we have no responsibility for our bottling companies because they're all independent contractors. Coca-Cola has actually handled this this whole situation pretty badly. They've been quite sort of defensive, and they have not presented their case at all. And I think they're sort of paying for that now with a real blow to their image problem, and a lot of problems at their stockholders' meetings. Now, the other question is, Coca-Cola is one of several companies that is licensed to use the coca leaf for legal purposes under heavy regulation. There is a legal coca market, and particularly in Peru and Bolivia, and cosmetics companies use coca leaves for some of their ingredients, and Coca-Cola also buys an undisclosed amount of coca leaf, which is then denatured and used as part of the natural flavoring in Coca-Cola. Obviously, Coca-Cola, until about 1910, had cocaine in it. When cocaine was declared illegal, they wanted to keep the flavor in their cola drink, but they did have to get rid of the cocaine alkaloid, which I guess ultimately didn't affect their sales.
Okay, and just can you just touch on terms of what the union was organizing, or what are they organizing for? What are the conditions of the workers? And I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure in the case of the Coca-Cola bottling plant what their demands were. I imagine that they had to do with wages, though.
Hmm. Well, other questions are welcome. We have about 10-15 minutes, more like 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Adam Isaacson. He's a senior associate at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and someone who has for a long time been following Latin American security issues, particularly American policy toward Central America and Colombia. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. a major concern for the United States in regards to Colombia is the drug trade. And it's been estimated that most of, in fact, I guess almost all of the cocaine that comes into the United States comes from Colombia. And so the United States has been eager to try to do something about that on the supply side, if not on the demand side. And so now for 5-6 years, the United States has been spending significant money in Colombia to try to deal with that. And this gets us to talking about something called Plan Colombia.
That's right.
Which I know you have written about and a lot of other people have written about that now goes back, I believe, to 2000.
That's right.
And there has been this commitment and significant money spent to try to deal with the flow of drugs from Colombia into the United States. And I think that a lot of people feel that largely this has been a failure. Let's talk a little bit about Plan Colombia, what the intent was, and as far as you're concerned, what the result has been.
Sure. In 2000, 1999-2000, when President Pastrana came to power in Colombia, the United States was becoming more and more alarmed, both about the strength of Colombia's guerrillas, but especially about greatly increasing cultivation of coca in Colombia. In 2000, U.S. satellites measured 136,000 hectares. A hectare is 2.5 acres. 136,000 hectares of coca in Colombia. And that year, President Clinton, with help from Republicans in Congress, it was a real bipartisan thing. They pushed through a special appropriation for Colombia called Plan Colombia, which gave Colombia $860 million in aid, about three-quarters of it for Colombia's security forces. The main goal there was counter-narcotics. It was going to make it possible for these spray planes spraying herbicides, a beefed-up version of the herbicide Roundup that you can buy in your garden store, flying over Colombian territory and just spraying coca wherever they found it. 6 years later, the United States has now spent, through the end of 2005, from 2000 to 2005, $4 billion in Colombia, of which 80%, $3.2 billion, went to Colombia's security forces. The other 20% was divided among development programs in rural areas, aid to the enormous internal displaced population, human rights programs, and other things. But the vast bulk has gone to the military, much of it in support of this fumigation program. In those 6 years, from 2000 to 2005, the United States sprayed 660,000 hectares of Colombian territory. That's like spraying the entire District of Columbia here, where Washington is. It's like spraying that 37 times over. After all those billions of dollars and all those hundreds of thousands of hectares sprayed, in March, the Drug Czar's office had to announce the amount of acreage in Colombia planted with coca at the end of 2005. It was more than what was found in 2000, 144,000 hectares. It actually grew by 8,000 hectares. How could that possibly be after so much money spent, such a hardline policy? Well, it turns out that Colombia is a big country. It's the size of Texas and California combined. And much of that territory, about half of it, only has about 4 or 5% of the population. It's jungle and savanna in which people can have migrated over the last 30 or 40 years, where they've gone, cut down jungle, and tried to grow legal crops, but with no government presence there, left up to the whim of the guerrillas or the paramilitaries, with no way to get legal crops to market, the only thing that has made money for them is coca. There's just been no effort to get a government presence into this really vast section of Colombia, the Orinoco and Amazon basins, and also parts of the Pacific coast, where people are just left on their own. The U.S. approach was not to help Colombia bring a government presence into these really empty areas and try to just do what a government does, build roads, guarantee property rights, all of that. We tried a shortcut, which was to just spray more. And rather than have government officials on the ground offering alternative development opportunities and even telling people that they shouldn't be growing coca because it's illegal, we just had planes flying overhead spraying these herbicides. And, well, the people who were the 4 or 5% of Colombia's population who were living in these areas, they did the rational thing for them, the only thing that was able to make money for them. They either replanted or cut the plants back and let them grow again and just sat out a couple of harvests, or they moved somewhere else, further from the Sperry Plains Range, and cut down more jungle and grew more. And, you know, the incentives, that's the way the incentives have been. People have not seen it as making sense to say, oh, well, I guess I can't grow coca here in the middle of the jungle. I'll try and grow rubber instead and see if I can make money. They've stayed with coca. It's time, there's more and more realization here in Washington that it's time for a new strategy. But there's really not any consensus on what that's going to be. There's been a lot more talk in Republican circles about devoting more resources toward interdiction, which is something that was tried in the 80s and 90s, trying to actually stop the stuff on rivers and on the sea and on roads. So maybe try that again. Democrats are talking more and more about expanding development opportunities and doing more of what the Republicans usually deride as nation building, you know, helping the civilian part of Colombia's government institutions provide opportunities. But there's not really much of a consensus. And in the absence of a consensus, for now, the policy continues to be really based on eradication, fumigation, and supply reduction, despite the rather shocking lack of results. Hmm.
Is there really anything that that farmers in Colombia could do, anything that they could grow, that would make them as much money as producing coca?
Probably. Well, actually, a farmer with a hectare of coca in Colombia, after they've paid for all of their inputs, all of the herbicides and pesticides and God knows what else, after they've paid their cuts to the guerrillas or paramilitaries, the UN estimates that the farmer with that hectare of coca nets $199 a month, about $6 a day, which is, you know, that's not enough to even, you know, have a car or anything like that, obviously, in Colombia. You're still poor. So many crops probably could give you the equivalent of $6 a day. But in order for that to happen, you have to be brought onto your national economic grid. You have to have access to electricity and water. You've got to have a road on which a vehicle can take your crops to market. You have to have access to information about current prices for various crops. You have to have title to your property, which, if there's a law enforcement presence, A, keeps that property from being stolen by somebody who just wants to kick you off of it, and B, makes it possible for you to get credit from a bank. All of these things are missing. You don't even have the most basic elements of a state to enforce the rules of the game in these areas. If you did, yeah, I think that there would be legal crops would make money the way they do in parts of Colombia that don't have coca but do have an agricultural economy. The trick is getting these people just integrated into the rest of the country. It's so extreme that there are parts of rural Colombia, even now, that, you know, once in a while a Colombian or U.S. reporter will visit and just report back on, you when you go to the center of the small town in these areas, there are stores and there's bars and things like that, but they're so far off the grid that there isn't even currency. You don't have Colombian pesos. Every store has a little scale on the counter where you weigh little rocks of coca paste, the stuff that the farmers, the crude paste that the farmers make from coca leaves, and that's how you pay in grams of coca paste instead of currency. That's how far off the grid these guys are. And you've got to bring all these areas somehow into the national life and national economy, and a military approach isn't going to do it. It's essential to doing it, but alone it's not going to do it. And unfortunately, 80% military aid and Uribe's heavy emphasis on military is about all that the residents of these zones have seen. So you're really working right now with half a strategy.
We will talk with some other callers here. Because someone in Charleston, that's line one. Hello.
Hi. I am very pleased to hear your guest. He seems very well informed and very impartial about the issues. I am Colombian by birth, naturalized in the United States. And I dismay constantly about the bad name of Colombia in the world. What he has said is so true about the lack of education, the lack of opportunity, and the desire for power of the upper classes. But in addition, if your guest could comment about what is the United States doing about the consumption of the drug. Obviously, the problem in Colombia begun and continues to be the power given by the drug selling of these drugs to countries in the world. But specifically, and all those programs that the United States is doing, it seems to me that it's trying to eradicate and give the solution to a little country. What is the United States doing about not consuming all these products? Thank you. Yeah. I will listen on the radio.
All right. I appreciate the question. And I know, Mr. Isaacson, that has been the chief complaint in places like Colombia and others that are drug producing or supplying countries. They say, well, we wouldn't have this problem if places like the United States and Europe and others, if there was not demand for the product. So they say maybe you in the developed world should be doing what you can to reduce demand, and then we wouldn't have the problem that we have on our side.
Right. You hear the words shared responsibility a lot from the Colombians and others when they demand that we do more. When U.S. officials reply to that, they say, well, actually the bulk of our counter-drug budget is spent domestically. However, they are usually talking about the cost of added police patrols in urban areas where there's drug selling, and especially the cost of incarcerating drug offenders. We have more than 500,000 nonviolent drug offenders in our jails. So sort of the same way that we've chosen the iron fist in Colombia, much more emphasis on spraying and military action than development or nation building, at home it's similar. We prefer the jails, we prefer the cops to drug treatment, which just about every study has found, including studies commissioned by the U.S. Armed Forces and the Drug Czar's Office themselves. Studies have found that actually the most cost-effective way to take money out of the drug trade and to reduce its impact here is to just increase access to treatment for the addicts here. Demand for cocaine and especially Colombian heroin has been either steady or increasing during the period of Plan Colombia. Most of that demand is accounted for, you know, not by a bunch of kids having a party once in a while. It's a real hardcore of addicts. It's a couple million people who account for the vast majority. These people are sick and they need help. They don't need to be locked up and thrown in jail. They do need is to when they're ready or when they need to get off of the drug, they need to have access to a treatment program. That tends to be underfunded in most of the United States. When an addict wants to get off the drug and they go to a publicly funded treatment center, the outcome more often than not is the individuals in the treatment center saying, great, we'll add you to the waiting list. It'll be about 6 months or so because we just don't have enough spaces, enough money for that. That's a shame because you've lost an opportunity to reduce the demand for the drug. And unfortunately, because of the size of our budget deficit and our commitments elsewhere, the Bush administration's budget for 2007 will slash funding for drug treatment even further. Now, why do we do this? I mean, why do we always opt for the iron fist approach, the get tough approach to drugs? Who knows? I mean, it seems to be part of our culture to do that. I mean, there's decriminalization is an option that really isn't even on the table here in the United in Washington because of the unpopularity of it. But also, if you're a member of Congress, you hear all the time about people in your district worried about drugs in their schools, on your streets, the associated crime, and they want you to get tough. And it looks so much tougher to spray the farmers in Colombia than it does to teach them how to grow another crop. And you also don't score any points if you build a jail, on the outskirts of town, you've just created a lot of jobs, right, for your district. However, if you put a treatment center right in the middle of somebody's neighborhood and lower their property values, well, the people in the neighborhood are probably not going to vote to reelect you. So there's a lot of domestic politics reasons why we are not really holding up our end of the shared responsibility.
I'll try and get one more caller quickly. Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Yes, just to make a quick comment. You said each farmer was making about $199 a month. It seems to me if we just paid him $199 a month, it'd be a whole lot cheaper all the way around for us, wouldn't it?
It probably would, since it costs about $700 a hectare just to spray on the stuff, and that's a rather conservative estimate. The outcome of that policy, of course, would be that you'd have just about everybody in Colombia on the U.S. dole at some point, and that wouldn't really be sustainable for the long term. But if that money were spent instead in roads and water and law and order, then it would make a big difference in these people's lives.
And it seems like it's time for us to think in a different manner in our drug laws instead of this stick technology we've been using all along. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're just about the point where we have to stop here. Maybe we have about a minute or so. Is something you can do to help us just wrap up, just for the moment at least?
Well, sure. I mean, pay attention next week. If you do pay attention to these things, that the U.S. Congress is going to be debating foreign aid to Colombia for next year. It'll be in the House of Representatives for the whole world, but Colombia will be there, and there's likely to be an amendment trying to shift some money out of military assistance to Colombia and into assistance for displaced persons. Believe it or not, that seems like a no-brainer. Move it from something that's not working to something that's badly needed in a humanitarian way. But it will be a tough debate, and we hope that we see a victory here, but we don't know. So pay attention to it and let your member of Congress know that you do want to see money, our priorities shift in Colombia, and that next week's debate is an opportunity.
Very good. Well, at that, we will stop for this hour and thank our guest, Adam Isaacson. He is from the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He's worked on Latin American security issues, particularly U.S. policy towards Central America and Colombia, now since 1995 at the center. Mr. Isaacson, thank you very much.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thank you.